It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Humans as a species have used other animals for food, clothing, companionship, and more for a long, long time. And more recently, humans have caused more and more generalized harm to animals. Things like air pollution affecting birds, habitat destruction limiting the range of migratory animals, plastic in the ocean getting in the stomachs of whales. Our next guest says we have a large and in many ways growing debt to pay these animals. She says we can start by getting the law to work more in their favor to protect their ability to flourish. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What concerns do you have about animal well-being? Is there a change you'd like to see made in our legal system, in our world, in our attitude toward animals? What is it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Martha Nussbaum is the Ernst Freund Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics in the Law and Philosophy Department at the University of Chicago. She's the author of many books on philosophy, economic development, and more. Her newest book is called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. Martha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on. I'm really looking forward to this.
You've written so many books over the years about philosophy and ethics as it applies to humans. What led you into considering justice for animals?
Well, I've been thinking about that for quite a long time. But even more because my daughter became a lawyer for animal rights and she was working for an NGO called Friends of Animals. And then in 2019, she died very tragically. So that made me think a lot more about writing a book on this topic. In fact, even when she was ill, I was already writing the book and she knew about it. And we had co-authored some articles together. But it was really my daughter that opened my eyes to the huge problems of animals when they're outside our national control. Whales were her particular passion. And so I learned a lot from her and then I took it from there and studied many other kinds of animals. And you know, there's so much good science about animals and we know so much about the wonderful things they are capable of if they can have a chance to flourish. So that is really what started me writing this book.
I want to talk about that idea of animal flourishing. A key concept to your book is something called the capability approach. Again, this is something that you've talked about when it comes to people. What do we mean about the capability approach when it comes to recognizing the well-being, the flourishing of non-human animals?
Okay, first of all, what it means is we don't think that an animal is worth protecting only because it's like us. It's each form of life has its own complexity and its own activities. And so the capabilities approach says, look at each form of life. And don't you think that each animal should have a chance to live a characteristic life of that species without human thwarting? But then it's also not focused narrowly on just one thing. I think utilitarians like Peter Singer have done a lot of good for animals by focusing on pain. But pain is not the only thing that's important in animal life. If we could just end all the pain that we cause to animals, that would be huge progress. But many zoos do not inflict pain on animals. And if the animal is born in a zoo, it really doesn't know what a real life for an elephant or for another large animal would actually be like. So animals need company, and company that's usually very complicated. Elephants need a large herd that couldn't possibly be in a zoo. Whales need pods, and dolphins too, of a large number of creatures. And so this leads me to a critique of zoos, among other things. But anyway, an animal needs lots of things. It needs room to move around in. It needs care and attention. And it depends on the kind of animal it is. What it needs, it varies with the kind. So that's what the capabilities approach says. Capabilities are not inside abilities. They are spaces for choice. They're opportunities to choose to live a life of the kind of creature you are. And so we should be creating those spaces in our world where a whale could live a whale life without getting choked by plastic and dinned in its ears by sonar, where elephants could wander and eat and wander across large tracts of land without dangers of poaching and without habitat destruction, and so on for every kind of animal.
You're calling for legal changes, and we can talk about that in a bit. You're also, I think, asking us to change as individuals how we think about animals. You give a series of emotions you're hoping we talk about, starting with the sense of wonder at our animal neighbors. How can we grasp that and kindle that?
Well, I've worked on emotions for a lot of my career as a philosopher, so it was natural for me to start there. And wonder, I think, is a good starting point, because when we look at animals, we don't just see something cheap and uninteresting. We're inclined to say, wow, isn't that amazing what whales can do, or what elephants can do, or what birds can do. We know so much now about birds. So wonder draws our attention to the creature and makes us see this creature as worthwhile, as an end, and not just a means of our own goals. And then when we have wonder, and then we also notice that the creature is suffering because of stuff that we've done, then I think we ought to feel great compassion. But then the compassion is not just, oh, poor elephant, but it's linked to a sense of, isn't it outrageous that this happens? We must change this. So it's kind of not a kind of anger that just beats people over the head with retribution, but a kind that faces forward. I call it transition anger. We turn forward to ask, what can we now do about this outrageous behavior?
We're talking to Martha Nussbaum about her new book, Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. You can join in with your reactions to what she's saying, your thoughts, changes you'd like to see in the way we humans interact with our animal neighbors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Kent is with us in Reedstown. Kent, hi.
Yeah, hi. I believe that veganism is the future of the planet. Conventional animal raising is not sustainable. We can get all the protein we need from vegetables, and industrial agriculture for supporting animals for food is killing us and the planet.
Kent, thanks for the call. Martha, not surprisingly, you talk about the way we raise animals and use them for food. What are your thoughts for Kent?
Well, I think the factory farming industry is a great moral horror. So I totally agree with Kent about that. And it's the first place I would want to start in making change, because it's got a stranglehold over American politics, so that it's very hard to make any other change until you first change that. But I also think that I don't totally agree with veganism in every respect. So let me have a kind of respectful disagreement with Kent. Veganism says, for example, we shouldn't wear things made of wool because that involves shearing sheep. Well, sheep have evolved in such a way that the coat burdens them. They will lead worse sheep lives if their coat is not shorn. So I see nothing wrong with wearing things made from wool. So there are many other places where we could have other examples like that. But I think the main thing should be to treat the animal as an end and to help it lead a flourishing life as the kind of animal it is. But I would certainly agree that stopping the factory farming industry, and how can we do that? Now, they have so much power that they've been able to pass in most states laws that are called ag-gag laws, meaning that they put a gag on people who want to be whistleblowers about the terrible conditions in the factory farming industry. And those laws have been repealed in 9 states, but they're still on the books in many other states. So if I wanted to take a video camera and go into the slaughterhouse and photograph what goes on there, I would be breaking the law. So these things first have to be stopped. Then when we can have true reporting about what's really going on, and of course we do have now books that describe the problem, but we need many more documentaries and videos, then the consciousness of everyone will be awakened, and then there will be a movement to end this terrible, terrible industry.
Kent, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Martha, we could take a couple of approaches to something like that. We could say all or nothing. We completely stop using animals for meat, or we live with what we've got. You see some room in some areas, I don't know about this one, in some areas for incremental improvements that we should be encouraged by. What would you see as some steps in that direction?
Well, I'm what is sometimes pejoratively called a liberal revisionist. That is to say, I do think it's right to make incremental progress. And when you think about the women's movement, something that I've written about a great deal, rather than saying all men are bad and let's separate from them and let's have a radical revolution, I was always in favor of trying to persuade, trying to bring people over and make legal progress gradually. So that's my approach here too, but I think it still is important to stop the worst horrors first. And the factory farming industry is certainly one of the worst horrors. However, it's so powerful in the US, unlike Europe, where actually a lot of reforms have already been introduced. In the US, people who are even candidates for high office have to meet with the American Farm Institute before they could be up for Senate confirmation. And so we have to break the stranglehold of that industry over our political life. And that's very, very difficult. But in the meantime, we can try to tell the truth about that industry, persuade people to change their own individual lives. And gradually, I think the law will catch up.
We're talking to Martha Nussbaum, professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. Her new book is called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Your thoughts, your reactions, your questions. Is there a particular animal that you are particularly concerned about that you'd like to see changes made to make their lives better? Call in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest on the philosophy, the ethics, the law surrounding the well-being of animals? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Martha Nussbaum, law and ethics professor at the University of Chicago. We're talking about her new book. It's called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts or concerns about animal welfare, animal cruelty, how we treat them in agriculture, in the wild, join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions, your own experiences, decisions you've made in your personal life at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Martha, a big part of your argument in the book is that you hope that legal systems around the world can take these ideas of animal thriving, their well-being, and account for them and represent those interests somehow. What could that look like?
Well, it has to have many layers. Right now, animals that are companion animals, animals we live with, are fairly well protected by local and state laws and some national laws, but those laws are not always enforced. So the first thing we need is that animals have to have what's known in the law as standing, that is the right to go to court as the plaintiff of an action. And of course, like humans, they don't go to court themselves. There's a lawyer, and in the case of non-human animals, there would be a guardian who represents the animals and hires the lawyer. But right now, no one can go and challenge the non-enforcement of the laws, because to have standing, you have to have what's known as a particularized injury, and no human qualifies for that, even if you're totally morally outraged by what you see going on. And so there has to be a change in that. And there are four countries in the world, Colombia, Ecuador, and Argentina, and India, where animals, in fact, do have that kind of legal status. And therefore, you can bring a suit in the name of the animal. So that's one very obvious change that I would like to see. But another is just more and better laws. So when we get outside the boundaries of the local, animals are not very well protected. We have some very good national laws like the Migratory Birds Treaty Act, the Marine Mammals Protection Act, and the Animal Welfare Act. Those are all federal laws, but they leave out the animals we eat. They just didn't want to have that discussion. So the bird treaty says, oh, it's just migratory birds, not the birds we eat, and so forth. Now, those laws are pretty good, but again, they need better enforcement. Now, courts play an active role in this. So I give an example in my book of a very wonderful Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision that interpreted the Marine Mammal Protection Act in a way that recognized the complex form of life that whales live. They saw that the Navy sonar program, while it didn't actually inflict pain on the whales, it did disrupt characteristic activities, migration, and it disrupted their mating activities. It made them migrate with reduced energy. It created heightened stress and so on. So they actually required the Navy to terminate its sonar program. That was a big win for animal protection. But of course, now that's in the coastal areas of the US, out in the high seas, so to speak, whales have almost no protection. They're suffering from plastic pollution. They eat plastic and it fills them up, and then they get so full that they die of starvation because they can't eat anything else. The plastic just stays there and it calcifies. They also suffer from noise. Oil drillers are drilling all over the ocean, and they're charting the ocean floor by sending sort of air bombs down to chart the contour of the ocean floor. And these air bombs make huge racket all the time. Whales navigate the world not so much by sight or by smell, but mostly by hearing. So it's created a great deal of stress for all whales. But what do we have? We have a thing called the International Whaling Commission. It was founded, however, to stop harpooning a little bit, to curtail it a little bit, in order to make sure that there are enough whales to be hunted in the future. So it was not a whale protective agency in the least. Over time, it's become somewhat more whale protective, and there's been a moratorium now on all harpooning, but it doesn't do anything about the other things that whales suffer from. And furthermore, nations have to join it voluntarily. Well, that's the problem with all international law, of course. If people don't want to do it, they just don't do it. So Japan, which didn't like the moratorium on whale harpooning, they just quit the International Whaling Commission. And so we really need a much better, more cooperative, and more enforceable international system. And I think the only way we're going to get that is raising public awareness around the world. And so that's one thing I want my book to do, because it's because people don't really know what's going on that they tolerate this. And I think if they really understood the sufferings of whales and dolphins and so on from the lack of law, then they would create a better system of law.
Talking to Martha Nussbaum about her new book, it's called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. She looks at philosophy and the law and animal well-being. Martha, the suffering you outline in the book, it would be easy to look at the enormity of it you point out and I guess be overwhelmed or discouraged. I think that's pretty clearly not what you're hoping people come out of your book taking. You point towards some signs of hope. Where do you point people toward?
Well, I think there is legal progress. Certainly there's progress in the protection of companion animals, but we also see inroads, as I mentioned before, some of the bad laws that the factory farming industry passed to prevent whistleblowing, those have now been repealed. And so we see progress in that way. As I said, the International Whaling Commission, bad though it is, has become better. It's declared a moratorium on harpooning. But I think the main thing that for people should think about is that every single person can do something. You can talk about animals and try to build a legal movement to protect one particular kind of animal you're interested in. You can, if you're a teacher or a parent, show videos. There's so much good information about animals that you can show in classrooms or to your children, just to show what their lives are like and get people interested in that. The Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, which I love, has countless bird calls that you can listen to, and you can learn about the life of each kind of bird and why it's precious. So whatever your position in the world is, there's something that you can do. You can join a local movement, you can join an international movement, and of course there's the movement to stop poaching, which has deprived many elephants of their lives. So they're just, everyone has something that they can contribute. I think what I can contribute is writing a book, but you know that I'm not an activist and I'm not doing a lot of the great work that activists are doing. So there are just many places that you can contribute. And I hope everyone here will realize that you can learn, and that already is progress. And there's something that you can be doing for animals in the world.
Martha, you pointed toward a couple of signs of legal changes. Do you feel as you're talking to people about your book that there is this kind of mindset change in the way we think of the well-being animals in the works?
I do think so. I think, of course, it happens first of all, in the case of animals that we live with. And I think that has really changed. People think of dogs and cats as beloved members of their family rather than as just tools. I don't like the word pet. I hope it will go out of existence because that word is kind of condescending. It treats the animal like a toy. But I think most people now do not treat their beloved dogs and cats like mere toys. I don't think they always treat them exactly well. I think dogs need a lot more exercise than they often get. They need a lot more close attention and interaction than they sometimes get. But, you know, people's intentions are good and they really do love these creatures. So now the next question is how to educate people about other kinds of animals whose lives are just as rich, just as interesting and complex. And they may be lovable like elephants, or they may not be so very lovable, like coyotes are really interesting animals, and more they live in our cities. So just educating people and getting them not to be afraid of a coyote and not to say, oh, we should shoot it on sight, because coyotes are actually very passive. They don't attack other animals or children, but they can be kept under control in our cities without killing them. So people need to just educate themselves and learn where the risks are to animal life and what they want to do about it. And I do see many, many signs of that happening. My daughter worked for this NGO that worked on wild animals, not so much domestic animals. And the wild animals, you know, there are lots of wild animals in the United States. She was particularly interested in whales, but that was really not in her office work. Her office work was concerned with creatures like the American bison, the wild horses, who are increasingly, there's a war between the cattle ranchers in Wyoming and the wild horses.
So we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Martha Nussbaum. Her new book is called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Think back to the last time you had a big test or exam to study for, whether it was years ago in high school or college or just last semester. How'd you get ready? Flashcards, practice tests, rereading your notes from class, maybe a little bit of everything. Our next guest says if we want to know what really works, we can look to psychology and how our brains actually retain information. He's looking mainly at school, but there are lessons here for learning at all levels, for work, fun, and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did you study during your time in school? Did you take thorough notes? What did that look like? Did you pull the infamous all-nighter to get ready for the big exam? What worked for you? What didn't seem to work? If you're a student right now, how do you study? Do you study? Teachers out there, how do you encourage your students to study and prepare? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Regan Gurung is professor of psychology and director of the General Psychology Program at Oregon State University. He's director there of the Center for Teaching and Learning, and he's co-author, along with John Dunlosky, of the new book, Study Like a Champ, The Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. He's a former UW Green Bay professor. Regan, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be back, Rob.
Well, one thing that I learned from your book is I might have assumed that, you know, I'm either good at studying or I'm bad at studying, and there's not much I can do about it. The good news of your book, I think, is we can get better at it.
And that is, I think, a great place to start, because far too often, I think people have mindsets that go, I can do this, I can't do that. And I think most of us have probably heard now, whether it's math or something complex, instead of saying, I can't do that, or I'm not good at it, a good way to go is saying, I'm not good at it yet. And I think that's exactly what we set out to do in this book, is to say, look, even if you haven't had success before, here are some really clear-cut things you can do that can make you better at it. And it just takes some practice.
You start with some myth-busting and public myth number one, I think, the idea of learning styles. So we each have our own learning style and we need to be taught and learn in a particular way. And this, a lot of people, I've thought this in my life. A lot of people that are listening right now, I'm sure, believe this, Regan. What does the research show?
So here's the big deal. I think I want to make clear the distinction between preferences mm-hmm. and matching a teacher and student's learning styles. We all have preferences. We all have preferences for how we like to do things and learn things. But what the research looked at is it really important for the way a teacher teaches to match the preferred learning style of a student? And a very large study looked at all the research that was available and came to the conclusion that matching teaching style and learning style is not important. And in fact, we tend to learn better if we are exposed to different styles. So if you are somebody who goes, oh, I am a insert learning style here. Let's say I am a visual learner, but this person uses a non-visual style, therefore I can't learn. Well, nope, the research shows that's just not the case. So don't use that anymore. That learning style myth has been busted for some time now, but like you said, it's got some staying power. It's still out there. And every year I see the memes out there about learning styles. And I think we've got to remember, move on. You don't have to match learning styles.
That said, there are some things we need to understand about ourselves. And here's one that really hit me. You talk about the idea of a feeling of knowledge. Like, and maybe at some point in everybody's school career, they had the thing like, hey, I got this. I'm ready to nail it. And then you don't nail it. You didn't know as much as you think you do. This is really important. How do we evaluate our feeling of knowledge of the upcoming test, say, versus where we really are?
Right. I think one big thing for us all to remember is that we are very good at deceiving ourselves. We are very good at deceiving ourselves, especially to make us feel better. And our cognitive processes aren't always a direct reflection of reality. So when we talk about the feeling of knowing or the feeling of knowledge, very often it really comes to play when we ask ourselves, do I know this or do I need to do more work on it? And very often we may be overly confident and think we know something when that's not really the case. And let me give you a really specific, I want to share something really specific where that really helps out here. Mm-hmm. This happens very often when we have what we are trying to study or what we want to know in front of us. So imagine studying with a textbook or, if you are somebody using flashcards, remember you imagine having a whole bunch of flashcards in front of you. I don't know if you watched somebody use flashcards, Rob, recently, but if you take a look at somebody using flashcards, they will do the classic flip of the card, right? They look at the term on front of the card and then say, oh, do I know this? And then do a quick flip of the card to look at the answer and go, oh yeah, I know it. Well, that's exactly one of those very practical things you can avoid doing to make sure that your feeling of knowledge or feeling of knowing isn't skewed. Because if you have what you're trying to study in front of you, that artificially inflates your feeling of knowing. You think you know it more than you really do because you're not factoring in the fact that there it is, you can see it. And whether that's a flashcard that you've just flipped or your textbook sitting there inflates the feeling of knowledge. You spend less time when you really should be spending more.
Talking to Regan Gurung about his new book. He's co-author, Study Like a Champ, The Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If there's something that's worked for you studying at in high school or college or learning to pass a professional exam, something on the job, something that worked for you, something that didn't work for you. If you're doing it right now, maybe you need some advice. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Regan, you looked at research that's out there that compared a lot of different things that can be, many of which can be helpful. What stood out to you as the number one or two things that really pay off for study styles and methods?
Yeah, let's, jumping straight to the punchline, as it were. If you have time, your time studying is best spent testing yourself on the material. That's the number one finding across cognitive science, is that repeat testing or repeat practice, you testing yourself is one of the best ways that you can prepare yourself to learn. And this is in contrast to spending time rereading the material, even studying highlighted material or even flashcards. I mean, flashcards are useful. Studying key terms are useful, but not by themselves. The number one thing you can do is test yourself. The second best thing you can do, and I'll give you the top two, right? Because these are the two that are head and shoulders over everything else. Repeatedly testing yourself and spacing out your studying. And I think in the intro, you mentioned cramming. What cramming does is the complete opposite of spacing, right? Cramming is cramming it all into the night before the exam. The flip side, spacing it out, that's what's really good for you. And I love the way my co-author John likes to talk about it. He says, if repeatedly testing yourself and spacing it out were to date, they would lead to the really best way to do it, which is test yourself repeatedly, but spread out over time. And that's what's really going to get stuff from your working memory into your long-term memory, and you're going to be able to hang on to it much longer.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us in Cottage Grove. Rebecca, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share my experience of going back to college in my 40s. I never have a college degree. I dropped out of college when I was in my 20s, and I always regretted it. And I always thought, I can do that. I could do that. And I never went back. I finally went back for a healthcare degree, which is a pretty demanding field, and I really had to learn how to study. And I just wanted to share how I did it. I actually graduated 4.0 top of my class, and I got a 97 on my boards. Yeah. And this is how I studied. So as an adult, you care more, right? Because you pay for your schooling out of your own pocket. So I wanted to study as much as I could, but I wanted it to be efficient. So I would tape all of my lectures on my phone and take notes in class, and then I would get home and I would rewrite my notes in outline form, and then I would listen to the lecture the next day on my way to school, and then in the end of the week on a Saturday, I would rewrite my notes again, but this time I would photocopy diagrams and color them in and label them, and then when I went to study, all my notes were perfection. So if I had to study, I had it all written two or three times already. And I kind of knew it all already, but I also made flashcards on my phone.
Wow.
Which now you can do in digital. So when I was sitting in waiting rooms, I would do flashcards. I was always quizzing myself. I would have people look at my flashcards and quiz me.
Nice.
I just did everything I could.
Rebecca, congratulations on going back, getting that degree, doing so well. I hear so much from your book there, Regan, spacing it out. She did that, you know, yep, over the course of time with the same material. Go where you want with it, because she gave us a lot to work with.
Oh, and you know, I mean, Rebecca, that's almost a case study in some of the best things to do. And I just wanted to highlight a couple of different things in there. The biggest thing I hope everybody listening saw or heard is Rebecca did a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. It's not just flashcards. It's not just one thing or the other. The real bottom line with studying is the more you do with the material, the better you're going to learn it. The deeper you process it, the better you're going to remember it. And I have to underline one big thing in what you said, Rebecca, because it's a whole chapter in the book, and that's note-taking. Note-taking is one of the most underutilized study techniques. It is an actual study technique. It's not just capturing information. And your example of writing and rewriting and playing with your notes, that's just such a neat thing to keep in mind, because when we take notes, we are processing the material more, and you doing that multiple times helped you process it more. And wow, yeah, no wonder there was a 97 there. So good job.
Rebecca, thanks again for calling. We're talking to Regan Gurung, professor of psychology at Oregon State University, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story in your own life of effective studying or less effective studying, something that you thought might work but didn't, or you were pretty sure wasn't going to work and were proven right along the way, or if you're a teacher, if you teach people stuff, love to hear what you see in your students. call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Regan Gurung, psychology professor at Oregon State University, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. You can join in with your study habits, how they worked or let you down. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Go back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Milwaukee. Bill, hi.
Hello, everybody. I taught writing English for MPS for years. In fact, I founded the creative writing department at the High School of the Arts. I stayed in touch with many of my kids at the beginning, and the main reason they were able to succeed in college was that they were able to write. I spoke to the superintendent that making reading the top priority is wrong, because reading is passive, writing is active. We work with journals, we wrote every day. Back when the head of the English department did a,
I think I got you, Bill, got some background noise there. But Regan, the value, I mean, especially with the subject like English, the value of writing and journaling and just constantly doing it.
Yeah, and I think that nicely underlines the note-taking point, because when you're writing, right, you're really having your brain do stuff with the material. And, you know, definitely in creative writing courses and in English courses, but I think writing in any format is getting you to do things with the material. That's why, you know, whether it's writing an essay or writing notes in class, instead of just writing down what's on a slide, you know, push yourself to write about what you're hearing, write about what you're reading. And even if you don't have a writing assignment in the class, you writing and pulling thoughts together and material together is having you do stuff with that material that, again, helps you hang on to it more and brings out more, you know. And that's why I think I have to throw in this, you know, in higher ed right now, there's all this, you know, a lot of us are concerned about ChatGPT and AI and writing. And it's almost like as good as ChatGPT is, the soul in the machine isn't there. And when we write, you know, there's stuff that's the emergent properties of our different thought processes are coming together in a way that where AI isn't there yet, you know, which is why any writing in class, any writing to process the material is going to help you learn better.
Bill, thanks a lot for calling in. Diane joins us now in Elkhorn. Diane, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I had a daughter that was dyslexic. She was a very oral learner, and when she needed to learn something, I would sing it. I would put it in a song, and she could learn it. I would sing her spelling words. I would sing her history facts, and now she works with a girl that has autism, and when she needs her to get dressed, she puts it in a song, and she has time to put on deodorant, and the girl sings, no stinky bits, no stinky bits. Anything I needed a child to do, if they wouldn't do it any other way, I would sing it, and oftentimes they would do it.
Diane, thanks a lot for the call. Whether it's singing or something else, Regan, I think creatively engaging with our material seems to be something that is going to help us.
Right, and beyond creatively engaging, what you see here is you're using more than one modality. So there's a more general term we call this dual coding. Whenever we're trying to remember something, if you can dual code it, where it's not just a word, but it's a word and music, or it's a word and a picture. To remember complex things, and in some cases, even things, you know, routines that you want to remember, if you can link something with either music or an imagery, it makes remembering certain things easier. And I think that's what we had here, was that it was almost a mnemonic device where that repetition yoked or tied to the melody helped, you know, recollection of it.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Regan Gurung, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. Back to your calls now. Maddie is on the line in Milwaukee. Maddie, hello.
Afternoon. How are you guys? Great topic.
Thanks. What experience do you want to share with us, Maddie?
Well, back to Rebecca, and I'm assuming it was nursing school. I also went back to school after having other degrees in my 40s, and at MATC in Milwaukee, I found an amazing instructor. Unfortunately, she's passed away, but she taught a learning strategies course that really opened up my eyes and made me realize what my strong suits were and how to really hold on to what I was trying to learn. And in nursing school, there's a lot of heavy material.
I bet.
And this learning strategies between auditory, tactile, which writing your notes, auditory by recording the lectures and re-listening to them, and then verbally saying things out loud as well. So I love what Regan is teaching, and I think the professors and the teachers out there have seen students struggle, and they're finding ways to give a lending hand any possible way they can, because our future is about education and people having passion in their work. And when you're struggling with test anxiety and so forth, that's when you start having people drop out of school.
So. Maddie, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Regan, the idea of a class in how to learn, I'm assuming you're on board with this idea.
Oh, absolutely. I actually teach a course in the science of teaching and learning where we go into it. And, you know, honestly, it's not even just the class. I think far too often, many of us, especially in college and universities, assume that our students know how to do this. And it's not that easy. There is science that shows you the right ways, but it's not necessarily what you would normally think of as being the right ways. And I think, I'm a big proponent of it, no matter what class you're teaching, especially if it's a first year class or a second year class, take time out of class to talk about study strategies, to talk about the best way to go. Because both Maddie and Rebecca alluded to, you know, many medical terms and a lot of terms to memorize. That can be stressful, but the good news is a lot of these strategies, retrieval practice and note-taking and spacing, those are exceedingly good, especially if you have medical terms or a lot of content to memorize. So right on board with that, we need to be talking about this more and not assuming that people know how to do it.
Thanks a lot for that call, Maddie. Regan, I want to talk about big picture strategy. In one of your chapters, you talk about scheduling, having our plan of how and when we're going to fit these different study methods into our actual lives. Can you tell us, give us an overview of that?
Sure. I think one of the thinking about thinking and planning all falls into the jargony term metacognition. But metacognition, or really planning out your studying, is really the first critical step to establishing a good study pattern. And I think this becomes even more important when you factor in that a person may have 2, 3, 4, 5 classes and work and all of these different things to do. So when you plan out or schedule out when you're going to study, that makes it more likely that it gets done, because then you can visually note what all you have to get done and where. It's also important to actually walk the walk of some of these key practices. I mean, I may say repeatedly testing yourself is good, and I will say spacing it out is good, but it's very hard to remember to space things out and remember to repeatedly test yourself when you've got 5 classes and work. So starting with scheduling, and you find the way you want to do it. I'm old school. I love paper. You can use, an app, but have a schedule of when you're going to do what, and that right there takes out some cognitive load, mental load, and it makes it easier to focus on what you have to do and when.
Regan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Regan Gurung, professor of psychology at Oregon State University, co-author of the book Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. If you have a lesson learned you'd like to share, you can still do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.